the jet engine of the computer science, artificial intelligence space is really machine learning. Maybe generative AI is like the rocket engine. Traditional automation and ERP is a little bit more like the propeller airplane, but the jet engine, the one that's going to get us the furthest over the next 20 or 30 years, is machine learning.
Welcome to the Leaders of B2B podcast, a weekly show where we bring you interviews and in-the-weeds expertise with today's B2B experts and thought leaders. You can see more about today's episode and guest by visiting our website at leadersofb2b.com.
Hey, leaders, welcome back. This is Ledge. Today, I'm excited to talk to Jason Radisson. Jason, welcome to the show. I have fun reading your extensive LinkedIn bio and the things we had in common and the things I want to learn about. So I would love if you would give just a little introduction. With the entrepreneur set, it's hard to even go, I don't know, how do I focus on this? So I let you say what's important to you. Welcome. Looking forward to a good conversation.
Yeah. Thanks, David. Thanks for having me on the show. And yeah, my name is Jason Radisson. I run a company called Movo, M-O-V-O, that I founded a few years back. We are venture-backed and building the human capital management platform for the frontline worker. Basically, what that means is we're taking a gig platform and retooling it, reconfiguring it as we build it out for large enterprises so that they can operate massive teams of workers and their huge frontline functions, basically in real time at the speed of thought, monitors on the walls, and then optimize things in the way that a bunch of us, as we were coming up and working the last few years on some of our other companies, have done in the gig economy.
Okay, so for everybody that doesn't know, human capital management software, HCM, you may or may not have experienced that. And then talk about what is a frontline role versus, you know, other types of roles.
Sure. So human capital management is sort of everything that it takes to not only hire and onboard your workers, but also to run them productively and interact with your employees in a modern version in the most kind of real-time and optimized way. So we, as we define it, it's optimizing a number of scheduling problems and thinking about what is the optimal deployment of people with their skill sets for every team in the company and enabling them to move in and out of teams and move in and out of shifts as they need to. And then a lot of the hygiene factors of being an employee, being able to communicate with everyone, being able to have your paperwork and your pay stubs and do things like same day, next day pay. For those of you that are out there tackling some of these payroll problems and be able to do things like task management. And you think about it, what is a ride sharing company or what is a delivery company? If you look at the gig economy, largely, it's this real-time virtual reality layer on top of a million simultaneous employees. So as we kind of looked at traditional employment, we thought there's this huge gap in technology. Most people are running around with ERPs and spreadsheets and clipboards, trying to run a few hundred workers at a time, when the gig economy is probably 20 years more advanced than that, where we're running millions of workers in real time. All algorithmically, all super optimized. If you think about 200,000 people leaving something like New Year's Eve in Las Vegas and getting picked up by Uber, how does that happen? That's a massive task management system. And for those of you who are out there distributing tickets in Jira, maybe 100 per sprint, think about distributing 200,000 in real time and then following up in real time. All this stuff is really available, and it's been available. The technology's been around for 15 years. So I think I'm part of my own journey as an entrepreneur is, I think in the world of automation, artificial intelligence, and really, I think most bang for the buck, the jet engine of the computer science, artificial intelligence space is really machine learning. Maybe generative AI is like the rocket engine. Traditional automation and ERP is a little bit more like the propeller airplane, but the jet engine, the one that's going to get us the furthest over the next 20 or 30 years, is machine learning. And if you look at a bunch of these relatively large problems that have already been solved for so long. The task that I think a number of us operating in this space have is to bring the advancements in science, the advancements in technology that are already out there, bring them to bear on some of the bigger problems in society. That really is sort of where we're coming from with Movo and why a team like ours coming from the gig economy is now working in the HR space.
Right. Okay. So the idea is you took cross-disciplinary learning, although it's really interesting because sometimes you take modalities from one space and you go, hey, that's actually the same problem with different inputs, but this is the same problem with the same inputs and nobody was paying attention to that.
Yeah.
This actually is human task management. That's an interesting innovation that why didn't somebody think of that before?
I'm used to it.
Yeah, and I've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs.
Yeah. There's an old book out there by Tom Davenport. It's called Competing on Analytics. And Gary Loveman, my old boss at Harrah's Entertainment and then Caesars Entertainment. And there was the whole generation, the pre-Moneyball generation was Tom Davenport was writing about corporate applications of automation. And Jeannie Harris was his partner, co-author at the time. Anyway, long story short, what Gary Loveman used to say about Las Vegas was like, you look at their was a Moneyball competitor, that was us at Harrah's. We were running around making twice as much revenue per square foot as everybody else on the strip using our algorithms. We were going to conferences, we were presenting our algorithms. If you look at the Harvard Business School publications, you'll find probably about a dozen case studies on Harrah's. Some of them even explicitly lay out the algorithms that we were using. And we're talking algorithms that drop $1 billion, $500 million each to the bottom line, and nobody else on the strip did it. So if you look at, you know, I look at this current generation, generative AI and the implementation in corporate. For those of you that have seen the hockey stick that is Accenture's implementation of AI pilots in the last few quarters, like Accenture is now on like a $2.6 billion run rate of annual AI pilot implementation. You look at none of that really sticking. There's something like a 95% fail rate on AI pilots. You look at all of these things. It's really hard. You need to be really aligned. And fundamentally, if you're going to implement automated processes, it's a different company than you have today.
Right.
And all of kind of the innovator's dilemma, all of the change management resistance, all that stuff kicks in, which is why I think AI is fundamentally different from the generation of SaaS founders and those of us who've grown up making ERPs for a specific client need. An ERP is fundamentally building off of what the client does and making incremental improvements to what the client is already doing, wrapping technology around the company's processes or the industry's processes or wherever you are. But fundamentally, when you're building like an AI and an automated process, you really want to throw that out. You really want to start from first principles of what's the actual way that a computer should do this process, which probably has nothing to do with how the company is currently doing it. That is the challenge. And I think that's the kind of Moore's chasm on steroids or whatever it is that we're facing here with AI. We've got to figure out as founders, we've got to figure out how to get somebody to throw out their current processes and take up fundamentally an automated process. That's the challenge.
Right.
But here we are. I'm sure we could talk about it all day, but that's why I do think being an AI founder is it's fundamentally an enterprise space. Enterprises have the data. Yeah. And then you're fundamentally, you are confronted with this incredible change burden that you don't have in a traditional SaaS, particularly like an ERP company.
Right. Like the sort of consumer AI conversation is somewhat interesting. Okay, I can clone.
Yeah,
that's super cool. But
for sure,
that's sort of useless relative to the idea of how are we going to make a sea change in this stuff where we're talking about 8 orders of magnitude change in 1 year across these vast enterprises. And it certainly,
yeah,
when you talk about it that way, you certainly get into the whole like, geez, just the basic case studies now. Hey, we replaced 750 agents with one model and we're good. You know, and it's like, wow.
Yeah.
And this is happening now. Read every single day the news.
Yeah, totally.
I think, and also I believe that you're probably on the sort of the wagon of, okay, this is going to make work more awesome for people to fit their lives the way that they want it to fit.
Yeah. And I think, you know, particularly if you look at my bio, maybe for the listeners also, is I grew up poor and in a rural poor community and with a single mom, with a single teenage mom. And for us, the reason I've been working on the frontline worker problem for pretty nearly my whole adult life is I think that's where all of the economic improvement and advancement in society comes from, aside from pure research. Like R&D is R&D. Certainly everything from our particle accelerators on down is helping advance us as humans. But if you look at like, how do I have broad impact? How can technology broadly improve the world? It happens with frontline work. And there's a, for sure, there's a phase where eventually we have the robotics that a lot of frontline work becomes obsolete. But fundamentally, like first, we're now solving the intelligence problem, and then we eventually get into the physicality in the robotics and things like that. Put another way, white collar work will be optimized a long time before blue collar work will be. And I think we've seen it, right? We have all these improvements from the mobile phone, the internet, the desktop PC, cloud computing. These will all fundamentally improve the productivity of white-collar workers. They look at blue-collar workers, deskless workers, a lot less. And so as we look at that and put it another way, we're working on the digitization of blue-collar workers. When you look at that, the first place you have to start is with resource allocation, because that's just the biggest. Like fundamentally, is the right person on the clock at the right place that they should be for where their skills are for right now and for what the market demands? And a large part of our roadmap and investment this last year or two has really been around fixing the scheduling problem or solving the scheduling problem, which is, you know, we have a bunch of proprietary tech around making sure that the schedule is always automated. The roster is what it should be across sites locally, across job classes locally. And you think of all the different places this plays out. For every hospital that has spiky demand for RNs in different departments, to every warehouse that's dealing with fluctuating order volumes, how important all this stuff is. And it used to be pre-pandemic, I think people thought, we'll just grow our way out of this. We'll get some temp labor if we need it. That's how we'll handle this. We'll just hire more people because we can hire as many people as we want. And no disrespect to the talent acquisition folks out there, but the lever is just not as strong anymore. It's you're digging and scrounging for the human or two that maybe you could hire. And so I think we're really seeing the market trying to make do with what it has. And that fundamentally is like a scheduling allocation problem. So long story, but that's why we think one of the biggest problems in the world for AI to solve is scheduling of frontline workers, and why we're really focused on that problem right now.
Right. And you must have to be tangent to this changing workforce dynamics then, if you're in this kind of discussion. How does that register? Because there's like productivity, and then there's like this whole sort of fear baked into the economy of, yeah, it's going to take my job. And, you know, and I mean, that's the extreme silliness, not dislike sort of the Terminator version of AI, but you can see it. There are enough stories that you can think, where the hell is this going?
And yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Do you all have to spend a lot of time planning or at least futurizing, because this pace of change, at least from a relatively educated observer, is like outrageous. You know, I can't remember a time in my career that you were just like, that thing just moved like an order of magnitude in 30 days. I mean, that's pretty extreme.
Definitely. I think there's a part of it that is like, clearly there's going to be a lot of displacement with generative AI, and there kind of already is, right? I think it's one of the not uttered aloud parts of the big layoffs that are happening in big tech these days, right? So part of what I think in the FANG is you look at it as they're both reallocating resources, right? Because here's this next wave of technology and we need to put development teams on it. And sometimes those developers aren't the same developers as the ones we had working on cloud or working on other projects. So there's a big sort of wave of reallocation happening there. But then the long and short of it is generative AI, at least for text-based careers like computer software development, like copywriting, for these kinds of things, really displaces a lot of the entry-level work. and really benefits the seniors. And so you basically, rather than having junior engineers on the team, you have co-pilots and you have just a lot less personnel. And so I think that displacement is happening, and I don't want to discredit it. And then I look at other areas. So what does that mean eventually, which is actually the senior computer scientist is going to be a lot more productive than they ever were, which all that extra productivity should mean even better wages. I look at operations and like the kind of stuff that Movo is really focused on. If you look at sort of store operations for a large retailer, that store manager might spend half of their time working on the scheduling problem and maybe a quarter of their time working on talent acquisition.
Yeah, I watch my 17-year-old having to change your work schedule is ridiculous. Texting all these people and total madness. And you're like, come on, guys. Like, I can get a car to show up at my house from a stranger in 5 minutes and you can't. Right. Obviously, you guys are right.
There's big upside there. And what does it then mean for the supervisor, or for that Walmart store manager? It means you freed up half their capacity. And then what do they work on? And of course, that should elevate that job, elevate the productivity of the store, elevate the productivity of that frontline manager. We look at where does our technology, like where is it moving cheese? And I think it's more like for the frontline worker, it's amazing because you no longer have to have an embarrassing conversation or compromised, feel like you're compromised with your supervisor because you're asking pretty please for time off. You just submit your request to the AI and it gets granted if everything's okay. And you've got peer-to-peer tools. If it can't be automatically granted because there's no substitute available, you can go and recruit one internally based on some pre-selected lists. And we've got right. other self-service tools like that. So from frontline worker perspective, I'm more effective and I have greater flexibility and I have modern tools. And we see that definitely is all those things are motivating for the employers that we work with. The supervisor, you know, is really more, they're more like a battle situational awareness kind of commander now. They've got, it feels almost like military grade tools. They know where everybody is in that situation all day long, every day, both from any of the geo awareness and shift management tools and things like that. And they can just be plugged in. Is that, are there people that don't want to do that kind of work, prefer the clipboard and not knowing and that kind of thing? For sure.
There's a lot of freedom in not knowing.
There's a lot of freedom in not knowing. There's a lot of job satisfaction for some folks in pounding the phone all day. There's a lot of job satisfaction walking around. Oh, I manage across 3 different warehouses. I need to drive between them all day long every day. Actually, you don't if you have modern tools. There are all those kind of displaced tasks and things that are now automated away. I think ultimately it means we should be telling our kids to go get operations research degrees, because that's the managerial role of the future is our guy or gal. You know some computer science. You need to know some optimization math. You need to know some supply chain and logistics math. Yeah.
Right. I remember people talking about, I'm going to go study OR. And it's like, oh, just kidding. We don't care about that anymore. And now 20 years later, it's like back.
Yeah. Yeah. If you look at the city teams of the ride sharing, delivery, gig economy companies, it is operations research people sitting in a room covered with monitors of real-time things happening. It's a little bit more like an air traffic controller job with a little bit more math, probably. But fundamentally, that's the job. And I think for a number of folks, it's incredibly rewarding to the extent that managerial science is moving towards real-time and all of this situational awareness. How else are you going to do it? Eventually, you'll be so senior in your career that you don't need to be plugged in real-time. You can just sit back and headquarters and make strategic decisions. But I think for most of us, and at this point, as I think of my own kids, like for most kids coming up too, you really need to be preparing for a world where you've got real-time connectivity in your job and a bunch of automation. And really those skill sets, being able to manage in that environment is, I think, where it's at.
It does certainly make you wonder what is going to be the nature of a job, you know, kind of And it's just, are we all going to be little blobs and like in WALL-E and just sipping smoothies while the AIs do everything? Or it's just, it's an interesting time to be alive. Let's put it that way, I guess.
Yeah.
I
mean, yeah. You
know, now it's like they skipped Googling at all. And now it's just, well, why would I need to do that? I'll just ask ChatGPT. You know, it's just like, right. Wow.
I'll get the summary.
Yeah. So yeah. You were transparent to share your background and growing up poor. And thank you for that. I wonder the psychology of an entrepreneur and wanting to make a difference in your path. Like the fact that you mentioned that means that it made an impact there through your path. And when you put together that 20 year sort of direction to where you are now, I wonder about lessons learned or things I'd tell myself 15 years ago that I wish I knew, or any of those types of things. I find those very interesting.
Just on that note, I think you look at, you know, sort of mission-driven founders, which I definitely consider myself to be. And we either, I think, come from either the school of guilt. We grew up so privileged that we want to give back. Or we come from the school of hard knocks and we have empathy for the plight of folks who are in bad situations because we grew up in bad situations. And I think as I look back on lessons learned, there are so many. But I think fundamentally, if you're starting a company these days, on the latest stat out of Y Combinator is something like 70 or 80% of their recent cohorts are generative AI companies. So I think the challenge is like really thinking through, you have to not only have a product that seems to a problem you want to solve and a solution for it that fits really well in a differentiating, defensible way, but you need to think about how that's going to scale up and how it's actually going to get adopted into the world. And, right. You know, as I share sort of my competing on analytics and competing on algorithms, and literally like we're talking at this point, 20 plus years ago, there is always the room. And even if you look at a space, you're like, nobody's competing algorithmically in that space, be a good spot. And so I think if you're looking at a space and you're like three companies have failed, like it all doesn't matter. I think what you need is a lock on data. You need a way that you're going to get to data. You need a perspective on what the UI is going to be to solve it in that space. And then you need some idea of how you're going to scale within, often it's going to be an enterprise, let's just face it, with right. Given that the data is all kind of residing in large enterprises, right? And I think that's the gauntlet that as a founder in 2024, you've got to navigate. And I think that's where all the exciting companies are going to be coming from. Now, that said, I think there's plenty of room in every major vertical for there to be at least one unicorn, if not decacorn. And it's just, we haven't seen the companies yet. Yeah, there'll be some broad sort of foundational companies like OpenAI, but really the value is not going to be in OpenAI. It's going to be in the companies that sort of are, the real value creation will be in the 100 companies that will come on top of this interest and investment in AI that we're witnessing right now.
And just like finding the overwhelmingly useful business case that is so brain dead that everybody wants to buy it. Yeah. And there are wild problems to solve.
Yeah.
Things make
absolutely
possible. Real-time data that could now be unstructured and turned into something useful. Not that happened before. Streaming data before it used to be a mess. And even if it was structured, what do you do with it? It's coming too fast. Now we can handle fast data and it doesn't need structure. And I think that is where I find excitement.
Yeah, totally. If we take an example, look at recommender systems, right? You've got Jeff Bezos and Holden basically creating an early version of the Amazon platform, doing a little bit of recommendations. If Dave Selinger, like probably 5 years later, coming out of that team and founding Rich Relevance, and then going and selling essentially recommender systems to big retailers throughout the US who were trying to keep up with the experience that Amazon was driving. So you look at that kind of technology development and you go, you know, similar problems. So how do you get the data? You have to partner with big retailers who have the data and the traffic and, you know, can reliably deliver on the orders that they're going to get. you have tried and true collaborative filtering recommender systems, right? And for everybody out there, I'm talking about like above the fold on the homepage on a big retail site, right? And the UI was clear. We all knew that it was going to be merchandise panels recommending products, right? And that was a multi-billion dollar startup problem that a few guys and gals went out and solved. And you look at us today and you go, maybe there's going to be one in legal, maybe there's going to be one in logistics, maybe there's going to be one in healthcare, 100 in healthcare. And you look across it and you can see, you know, but like I said, you got to solve data. You got to solve what's the UI. Right. Sure as hell isn't going to be chat, you know, on maybe 98% of these cases. I mean, right. You know, and then how are you going to convince large enterprises, like what's that integration point look like? And eventually, yeah, you'll have Accenture screwing this stuff in and IBM screwing this stuff in, right? So lots of challenges out there. And I think we're going to have continuation of kind of this Cambrian explosion for a while until it settles down and people start to prove out playbooks and venture capital industry can get behind, like, this is how founders should be stamping out AI companies. I think right now, nobody knows, in my sense.
A lot of the chatter seems to be the next generation being about, which I guess is another spin on automation, these, you know, ideas of autonomous agents that can make reason judgments for the next right thing to do instead of having a decision tree. Is that realistic?
Yeah. Look, I think there are definitely consumer use cases for it and there are expert use cases for it. I think, I don't know, would it, as a lawyer, would just to name an example and something I have armchair knowledge about, as a lawyer, would you send an autonomous agent to go research a case? Or would you just hit a button and get the research back? And right. I don't, it's for, let's say, brief drafting or another sort of paralegal entry-level legal task. And that's where I think it's just so much can be scripted. So I don't know that you're going to be chatting with an autonomous agent as much as you're going to have domain-specific UIs that
That's what
you
I was thinking.
With.
It's going to be a series of AI-fronted throwing catch between all your apps, not dissimilar to, like, I have to think Zapier is in love with this because it's just basically,
right.
All right, app A throws out some stuff and then there's AI to make it into what app B needs and try to be smart about it. That was always the challenge of just, oh, look at this data format. This sucks. I can't actually do what I want. And now you probably can. So
yeah,
they're probably pretty stoked about that.
Totally. So, and it does, you know, and I think I mentioned it earlier, probably bears underlying, like, it definitely favors large companies. I think that's on so many levels, not least of which is liability, right? So anytime you're talking about basically automating decisions, yeah, a large company is going to be advantaged on data. They're going to be advantaged on their insurance or ability to self-insure. I look at things that, like, in the HR field, how much of HR is compliance, right? A few HR professionals have law degrees. Most HR professionals have a number of sort of broad skills and some specific skills around compliance. Could compliance be automated? Of course. We automate it all the time in our company. And who's going to shoulder sort of the exposure of automated personnel decisions? It's going to be a company that can get that underwritten by Lloyd's of London or Berkshire Hathaway or whatever, or self-insure. And I think there's a world where a big part of just everyday white collar, as we're looking at it, becomes more and more the domain of some of the big tech companies and others that decide to get into the space. Right. So I think you're sort of looking at portfolio strategy in the FANG. I got to think that domain-specific AI is a big area of development. Everything favors them, really, at this point.
Just what everybody wants to hear.
Right, right. Makes it easy from your 401k kind of perspective, like, you know.
So buy the NASDAQ and you're...
Exactly. Definitely. It's interesting.
We're not giving investment advice, friends. We are not. We are not.
We are not. We are not. Talk to somebody who's really an investment professional. But.
Right, right. Jason, yeah, appreciate, you know, the insight. You kind of answered what should be on the radar question already and neatly there. So I'll flip the last one on you and say, all right, when you're not doing this and regular life is in front of you and there's not a startup adventure, and how do you keep the balance, the mental alignment, family life, all the things, and keeping the brain and emotions together? I think that isn't talked about enough.
Yeah. You know, it definitely, you need balance. And my particular balance, I think it's been really helpful that I've done endurance sports my whole life, because I think it gives you your own personal well-being and fitness as day-to-day barometer. And in my case, it's been running as my main sport. I ran cross country from the eighth grade on. I grew up in a town where that was one of the only things that we had to do other than wander the woods. And that's my other passions are, of course, my family. I have four kids, and being outdoors with them as much as possible, whether it's skiing, hunting, fishing, boating, whatever we can do to get out there and get in the woods or get on the water.
The funny thing is, I never talk to any founders now. It's 250 some odd interviews, and nobody ever goes, yeah, I get up at 4:30 in the morning and I journal, and then I meditate, and then I drink six raw eggs. And so all this crap that you read, I try to think about the pop startup press that gets jammed down right. your throat in your newsfeed all the time. And I said, nobody like ever.
Right.
And I do talk to a lot of endurance athletes who are successful entrepreneurs. I think that there's unquestionably a strong correlation, if not causation, with that. Somebody should figure out that algorithm. Maybe it's not about the business. It's about the, you know, the fortitude to get your ass kicked.
And then pick yourself back up.
Right.
And I think as I get older, I really like marathons. And I think, A, let's face it, probably half as fast as I was in high school. And B, like, it is all about the long game. And if there's meditation, I think you get the mind over matter a lot in endurance, because at least for me, whenever I'm doing a longer event, I get reminded of every injury I ever had. There's a half mile where I go through every injury. Oh, damn, right. That hip again. Oh, that shin. Oh, that broken foot. Oh, that torn tendon. It all comes back, and you got to get over it and go, yeah, this too will pass. Keep going. And I think it's that. And if you look at sort of, you know, what it takes to be mentally fit and lead a long life, or the best odds you can give yourself is doing some kind of aerobic activity 3, 4, 5 times a week. That's everything to aging well, pretty much, besides not being excessive with drinking and certainly not smoking or any of the other really bad things that you could do.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much for sharing. Great conversation. Love the insights. If folks are resonating, business or otherwise, with this, what are the best channels and places to keep up with you, follow you, say hello?
Yeah, absolutely. And they can certainly look us up at our website. That's movo.co, movo.co. Also on LinkedIn, we have our company page there at Movo HQ. Find me on LinkedIn just by my name, Jason Radisson. And my email address is jason@movo.co, jason@movo.co. So any of those ways, all ETS.
Sure. Appreciate your insights and your time today. I know everybody's going to take away from it. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on, David. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for listening. And we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Leaders of B2B podcast. And as always, you can see more information about this episode and all the resources mentioned at leadersofb2b.com. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a 5-star rating. This episode is brought to you by Content Allies. We help B2B companies launch revenue-generating podcasts. We schedule interviews between you and your ideal prospects and strategic partners. You show up for engaging conversations. We handle everything else. Ready to build a podcast that grows your business in just 1 hour per week? Reach out to us at contentallies.com.